Dialogue is a tricky thing. It's not just the exchange of words. It is the sharing of ideas. And on the surface, that sounds straightforward until you realize it's a complex interplay of thoughts, agendas, emotions, and competing interests, to name but a few. Now, add in the demands of running a program at Simon Fraser University, complete with engaged, intelligent staff and associates, but don't stop there. Be a professor as well. Then take a break from those jobs and run for the mayor of Vancouver. So what does this career look like, and how do you ever plot a course to do it? In this episode of Careers That Matter, Shauna Sylvester takes us inside her world and her career. Shauna Sylvester, you have quite an interesting job. What exactly is it? Like, what's your title and what does it entail?
I'm the executive director of the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. It's a mouthful. I'm also a professor of professional practice at the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. So it is a long title, but my job is very simply to hold the space for very difficult conversations that we're having in society and to support dialogue to get us to a better place.
So how do you manifest that objective? Because my sense in talking to you is that you go, okay, well, I'm an administrator, I'm an instructor, I'm a facilitator, I'm a, somebody who brings together a community. Yeah. It's a diverse set of responsibilities. So what does it look like?
Well, on any given week, I could be dealing with housing issues. So I have facilitated a mayor's task force on affordable housing, both in Vancouver and on community housing in Burnaby. I could be dealing with transportation and land use planning, as I'm doing with the Metro Vancouver mayors and many other stakeholders. I could be looking at the issues from hope, from hate to hope in a digital age, and facilitating that. I could be looking at the issues of belonging and democracy. So on any given week, I am facilitating complex conversations. What it means in practical terms is I work with a team, an incredible team of people who are fellows or associates and staff who work in dialogue in climate solutions, urban sustainability, health and complexity, diversity and innovation. We run a social enterprise. We support governments in their public decision making. I teach. I'll be teaching on democracy in May and June, 9 to 5, 5 days a week for 7 weeks. And in addition to that, we have a purpose-built building that was created in 2000. We're coming up to our 20th anniversary. The only center for dialogue in an English-speaking university in the world, and one of the first centers in the world, which holds the space for dialogue. It was built for that. So I direct that as well. So it's a very complex, fun, interesting job, and I get to work with fantastic people.
You've used the word complex 3 or 4 times in that description, and that in itself suggests that there's a tremendous amount of understanding that you need to have about these complex topics, because without it, how can you facilitate dialogue? You may be able to support, a directed presentations, but dialogue is the exchange of ideas. The only way that you can facilitate that is if you appreciate, at times, opposing perspectives.
Absolutely. And if you don't have opposing perspectives, it's not really a dialogue.
No, it's not.
No, it's just talking to the converted. So creating and setting the table, I like to think of it as a dinner table, where you set the table and you invite different people to come in to bring whatever views, whatever ways they have of engaging with that issue. And my job is to ensure that that conversation can be had, and it can be had in a constructive way in which people listen. Doesn't mean they need to agree. And sometimes we're working towards a policy end, like supporting a government in a specific policy. And sometimes we're just exploring the edges of an idea. Mm-hmm. And so it can be very generative. It can be what we call deliberative. So there's different forms of dialogue. This whole area of study is fairly new in the world. I think that we are at Simon Fraser University on the cutting edge of really understanding the knowledge and the practice of dialogue.
Who is the most important audience for the Center for dialogue? Is it decision makers? Is it industry leaders? Is it the general public?
It really depends on what the nature of the dialogue is. It tends to be, in the case of the Burnaby Task Force on Community Housing, there you had a very difficult issue that a mayor was walking into. They originally came to SFU, they came to me and said, would you facilitate the task force? And that was a stakeholder task force. Mm-hmm. Those are people from development, renters, users, people with lived experience, unions, businesses, a whole range of stakeholders. And we said, yes, but we think that there's a far more important conversation that has to be had in Burnaby right now. Mm-hmm. And that was with citizens. Because citizens had watched what was a very unaffordable community become very unaffordable. They had also seen dislocation of people, their neighbors, in numbers that they had never seen before. So that conversation had to be had with citizens. And so then we designed a process where the stakeholders and the citizens talk to each other.
You know, I think about the Citizens Assembly as put together by Adam Kahane, and the response from the city of Edmonton saying, okay, this is a representative example of how we can move towards, you know, carbon neutrality in the city of Edmonton. Do you foresee a role like that for the Centre for Dialogue in an expanding way? I'm bringing that up because you talk about the role that you played in Burnaby.
Well, it's so interesting because the whole notion of a citizens' assembly was born at the Morris J. Wass Centre for Dialogue with the first electoral reform process. Mm-hmm. And it was Gordon Gibson and Jack Blaney and others who created that very first pilot of a citizens' assembly, which is now being emulated around the world. Ireland now has it. Last year, our Welsh Community Dialogue, Professor John Gastel, who is an expert in this space, challenged us at the center and those of us around the table, okay, stop resting on your laurels. That was an innovation in citizen engagement. What's the next one? We have the Oregon review process. There's these different kinds of innovations. We've been doing a lot in the deliberative space. Citizens' dialogues are deliberative processes. I've been doing them for years and years, and we're modifying those, learning more.
Okay, so there's a young woman right now watching this interview, and she's going, Shauna, I want to be you. How do I become you? What was the path that in your life journey that brought you to where you are now, where you are empowered with the experience and the depth of knowledge that's needed to be able to facilitate the movement forward of the Center for Dialogue?
I'm really hopeful this young woman follows her own path, and because I don't think she would like mine.
Let's not limit it to young women,
too. Okay, men, too. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. To young men, and there are a number at the center as well. I wanted to be a nun. And I wanted to be a nun because I wanted to pursue philosophy and justice and understand that. I left that because I worked in places like Bolivia and elsewhere. I worked in many different countries. I studied anthropology. I studied and tried to learn and have lived experiences around different kinds of issues. So I lived in Bolivia, I lived in Ecuador, I lived in Indonesia, I lived in Quebec, I worked in a cabane à sucre in Quebec. And for me, university was a time to reflect on what I was living. I worked full-time and went to school full-time. I worked deeply with people living with disabilities. I worked taking care of aunts who were ill. I worked as a nurturer, a caregiver, and I worked in what I would consider philosophical rounds, studying things, understanding them, writing. I worked in the International Development Education Resources Association. I created five different social enterprises over my life, or initiatives. So I don't want anyone to have to follow what for me is a very circuitous route to get to where I am.
But wouldn't it have to be for anybody who wants to move into this position that you're in? Because you have to have a broad perspective on life and on people.
I think that there are some core competencies. One, you have to care about people. You have to want to be in deep relationship with people. And you have to feel uncomfortable when people don't agree with you.
You have to be very uncomfortable that people won't agree with you.
Yeah.
And you need to hold a space when they don't. And it's interesting because I'm a trained debater. And the transition from debate to dialogue was huge for me. And I ran for political office and I had to find my debating chops again. And it was really interesting because it was hard. Because I wanted to probe what people were saying. I wanted to build on their ideas. I wanted to find the center of what they were saying. And yet the machine that I was in caused me to go back into my debating role.
Because those are the...
Those are the skills that we use. You need to determine how I'm different, you know. Find the gap, go for it. So to do dialogue, you need relationships. You need to care about public issues. You need to not have a sense that there's one way of acting, that each of us hold a different piece of the puzzle,
mm-hmm.
and that your job as a facilitator is to hear what that piece of the puzzle is, to bring that into the fold, to see connections. You also need to look at the world in nonlinear terms. You have to see the issues of equity and power and colonization that has happened throughout the world. You need to have a sense of history. You need to have a sense that, you know, our systems are creating in the likeness of certain groups. And that has created unequal playing fields so that when people come to the table, they're coming from very different experiences, and you need to set up processes that enable that and don't prefer or create preferences for certain groups. There's lots of complex skills, and I am every single day I'm learning. This is an art, it's not a science. You constantly have to be learning and looking internally to say, how am I and my behavior serving as an obstacle to getting something done? So I've had to do, I would say the last 10 years, I've had to do some deep reflections on who I am as a person and how I present an obstacle for real solutions.
Okay, for any of us, especially as we aspire to continued improvement and that self-reflection, we also are part of a collective experience. You didn't get here on your own. So who were the major influencers in your life?
Yesterday I had to give a speech on my superpower, which is an odd question. And I actually came to conclusion that my parents and the upbringing they gave me is the source of my so-called superpower. They taught me at a very young age that I lived in relationship. I was a social being, not an individual. And that with being a social being meant I had to have a sense of commitment and responsibility to my community. And that was a powerful upbringing. They taught me also that the world wasn't a fair place. Mm-hmm. I had privilege, I had luck, but if I didn't stand up where injustice occurred, then I was complicit. So there was that kind of upbringing of a sense of social justice. Career was a bad word in my family. It was too self-serving. So my parents didn't ask me what I was going to be. It was, what was I going to do? How was I going to serve my community, and what kind of change was I going to create? Those were the questions. And my mother, who died of Alzheimer's 2 years ago, when I cared for her final 8 years, I rebelled against my mother. I felt like her view of my role, which was a very sexist role. As a woman, why should I be, you know, sleeping with my great aunts and taking care of them and nurturing them in the summers of turning 16 and 17? And why was I always cleaning the kitchen when my brothers were playing football? And why didn't they pay for my post-secondary education and my brothers went to private universities in the States? And so I rebelled very strongly. But what I didn't recognize was the power that my mother had created within me, which was to see people, to understand that people are frail, that they're vulnerable, but they're also powerful. And that my job in life was to deepen connection, to build relationships, and yes, to work with people, because I was never going to be successful on my own. So those were powerful lessons. And while they might have been tinged with a bit of female-male stereotyping, they there's nothing like caring for your mother while she's slipping away to recognize just what she's giving you. And that was something I'm very grateful for.
Well, and it leads to a fulfilling career, does it not?
It sure does, but I'm not sure I'd call it a career.
Okay, well, in the spirit of your parents who said it's not, you know, what do you want to be, but what do you do? There's fulfillment then in whatever you do.
I think it's that idea of leadership is what is it that you are bringing? What are you doing? And how are you supporting others in creating the conditions for them to thrive as well? So that is part of my mantra. And it takes me to all sorts of different places. And I couldn't tell you from one year to the next what that will be next. It will depend on where I feel I can best use my skills.
Well, by looking in the rearview mirror, you've had an extraordinary journey and impact. And please keep going. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Stu.